Over NBC's coast-to-coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Today, the Roundtable discusses freedom in an age of danger. Taking part in this discussion are William R. Ming, Jr., lawyer, Robert Horn, political scientist, and Louis Wirth, sociologist, all of the University of Chicago. To open today's discussion on freedom in an age of danger, we present Mr. Horn.
In the same week that we are celebrating the 159th anniversary of the Bill of Rights, President Truman has declared a national emergency, saying, if the goal of communist imperialism is achieved, the American people will no longer enjoy the blessings of freedom. Freedom of worship, freedom of reading, freedom of listening. They will lose the right, the president said, of free speech, the right to choose and criticize their government, the right to choose their own business, and they will lose the many other rights and freedoms of our way of life. What are the problems of protecting freedom in an age of danger? What are we doing to protect these freedoms? And are we succeeding? Ming, what do you think about that?
In my judgment, Horn, the basic problem is that of balancing measures which must be taken for the security of the nation against the protection which must be provided for individuals. The broad general principles of the Bill of Rights won't alone provide the answers because of the increasing complexity of the problems. But the procedural safeguards, such as the right of the writ of habeas corpus, the right to jury trial, the privilege against self-incrimination, and so on, will provide protection for individuals. How well we're succeeding really depends on our ability to interrelate these factors.
There is no doubt, Ming, that we live in an age of danger. But I fear that in the struggle to defend ourselves against this external danger, we're in equal danger of destroying our liberties by our own action and by our own inaction. When I see, for instance, the Attorney General's list of communist front organizations which are called subversive, when I see the imposition of special oaths upon faculties of great universities and civil servants in addition to their constitutional oath, when I see that there is no distinction made anymore between a loyal opposition and between treason, and when I see the legitimate American movements to improve our way of life deteriorating because people are afraid to be associated with them, then I think we ought to be concerned about the future of our heritage of freedom.
Worth, what you're saying is an indication of some of the things that have been happening as the Cold War has continued and become a hot war. We face a prospect of a long period of conflict in which each side in this war is trying to destroy the unity and the productive power of the other group. And our question, I suppose, is how can individuals be protected at all under these conditions? I suppose that all of us would agree, wouldn't we, that betrayal of military secrets or espionage or sabotage must be prevented. Ming, would you agree to that?
Of course I agree with that. The basic difficulty is of determining what steps are to be taken to prevent the betrayal of military secrets to meet the threat of sabotage. As an illustration, in protecting military secrets, what are the military secrets? How are we to determine what information is to be classified as secret? How much of particular kinds of information should be kept secret and from whom?
Obviously, Ming, the country has to protect itself in a time of danger. But as you say, the question is, how far does this protection have to go, and with reference to what things? When, for instance, we are confronted with military documents or state documents, all of which are classified, We can't make any longer any judicious discrimination between what is important and what is unimportant. If everything is secret, well, then the whole purpose of security is destroyed.
Ming, is there any difficulty with resolving every doubt about what should be classified, what should be kept secret, on the overcautious side?
I think there's a very real danger. In the first place, one of the things that all of us should remember is that alert and intelligent intelligence officers, whether they're officers of the United States or of some foreign power, have amazing ability at pulling together small scraps of information to serve as the basis of valid inferences with respect to large matters. That makes intelligence and security officers on the other side, who know they can do the same thing, inclined to be cautious in their judgments as to what should be classified as secret. But I'd agree with Worth that if that overcautiousness results in large amounts of matters and great areas of subject matter being classified as secret, that the very purposes of security are destroyed.
Especially when millions of men share these secrets. I would like to call attention to another problem, Horn, in that connection. It isn't just a question any longer of secret weapons, that is, of military inventions. It is also a question of the minds of men. You're involved in an ideological struggle, besides being involved in a struggle of power. And that means that the thoughts of men and the subversion of a political opinion and of the morale of a people is also part of the military procedure. And we must therefore look at the problem today in the light of these new dimensions that go way beyond any former conception of treason or secrecy or openness.
Well, Worth, we have to admit that the advances in psychological warfare, as you suggest, complicate our problem tremendously. Now, I suppose our question is, what kinds of techniques have we developed for dealing with these large numbers of people? How do we compare this problem of security with the problem of giving fair trial to a suspected murderer, for example?
Well, one observation that certainly ought to be made is that in the terms in which Worth states the problem, its volume as compared to the volume of the trials of suspected murderers or bandits or other criminals is tremendous. We're talking in terms of millions of people as contrasted with the trials of a few hundred people in any jurisdiction.
And that means not merely people in government service, in the Army and Navy and the Marine Corps and the other armed services, but it means also the industrial workers in the plants and the engineers. And it means the citizen who hears something that might be of value to the enemy. And all of that complicates the problem even further. Now, the techniques that we have used is, well, we've asked people to take oaths. Obviously, all people who call themselves American would be willing to take such oaths, to be loyal to the country. And even without an oath, they could be held for acts of treason if they committed them. But in addition to that, we have loyalty investigations. We have investigations of security risks. We have hearings before boards. Sometimes when a man applies for a job, it takes months before he is certified for the job. And what happens in the meantime, of course, I don't know. We have, on the other hand, people calling each other names and accusing each other in the halls of legislatures of treasonable acts, or at least acts that might be conducive to the ends of the enemy. We have a very fuzzy idea nowadays as to what is the difference between legitimate criticism and acts of subversion. And under these circumstances, I think no one really knows where he stands, and everyone suspects his neighbor.
Of course, these problems are not entirely new, are they? Some of them, quite a few of them, developed during World War II. And we might look at our experience during World War II for a moment to see how much help it is as a precedent. What would we say? Would we say that we had surprising success in maintaining and protecting civil rights during World War II? Would we say that we had much more success than many of us thought we might have immediately after Pearl Harbor? Ming, what would your judgment be about that?
Well, my judgment's a little beclouded by the fact that I was in the Army in World War II. And I think it's safe to say that the civilian concept of civil liberties and the protection of the rights of individuals has no place in any army. I do think, however, that without regard to any of the other things that were done in World War II, that the action which we took in interning Japanese-American citizens was probably one of the most horrible examples of the denial of civil liberties in the history of our country.
Horn, in answer to your question, I should like to say that just before coming down here for this University of Chicago roundtable, I looked over an old document of a similar roundtable that we gave here in this very room in 1940. And in that roundtable, we expressed some of our fears and some of our hopes for the conduct of the war, if we got into it. And I am certainly gratified, looking back over the record of World War II, that we had a much better record to show than any of us perhaps anticipated. And in many respects, it was a much better record, with the exception, as Ming has pointed out, of the Japanese problem, than we had in World War I. But since the end of World War II, I don't think we have done nearly as well.
I would agree with you, Worth, that when one considers the tremendous amount of criticism of the war effort during the war itself and the discussion of post-war plans for peace, that our record was pretty good. The Japanese internment, however, is very much on the bad side. But what legacy have these experiences during World War II brought to us? Has it changed our techniques of restraining individuals at all? Are we carrying some of the devices and some of the practices that were used during the war over into this peacetime, if we can call it that? Ming, do you notice any of these practices being carried over?
Well, I think there's a very real danger that techniques which are developed in wartime for dealing with large groups of people as over and against the heritage of the treatment of individuals as individuals is carried on not only from wartime to peacetime, but becomes a part of our thinking about how to deal with people in our community. I think, for example, that one of the worst things about the Japanese internment and its subsequent approval is the fact that we have again and again proposals that people of one kind or another who might constitute a danger to us should be treated as groups, either interned or kept from something or put someplace. I'd say that that was a direct result of what we did with the Japanese in World War II, and I don't want to see it repeated. I don't want to see it repeated with respect to any group of people, no matter how dangerous anybody else may think they are. I want to see individuals treated as individuals on the basis of what they as individuals do.
And that means, I take it, Ming, that we don't want people put on a subversive list merely because they belong to an association. We don't like the idea of guilt by association. I don't like the idea of guilt by mailing list. And I don't like the idea of sheer guilt by coexistence, because there's some other people in the world who think differently from what we do, and therefore we are associated with them in the public mind. I think this general group condemnation is certainly a disservice to a democratic society.
How have we traditionally approached the protection of individuals in our constitutional system? What has been the formula that we have used, Ming?
Well, our judicial processes, with their requirement that individuals have a fair trial, the protection of a jury trial, the right to have charges specified against them, the right to be confronted by their accusers, the right to see the evidence that's going to be used against them, the right to cross-examine witnesses that are produced against them, the right to the help of counsel in their trials, are the great protections that our system provides for individuals.
I suppose, however, Ming, you would make an exception to that. Nobody can pretend that you can have civil liberties of the civilian sort in the army itself.
Well, I think I said that the concept of civil liberties as we know them in the civilian world has only a limited application in the army, although some of those protections, like the right to counsel and the right to cross-examine witnesses, the right to be confronted by the accusers, are well recognized and have been for a very long time, even in our military law.
But to what extent are these rights recognized, that is to say, for government employees nowadays?
The real difficulty, I think, Worth, is the notion that we've developed that government employment is a privilege and an honor, when as a matter of fact, if you have, as we now have, more than 2 million government employees and something on the order of 5 or 6 million additional people in the Army and the Navy, and then some very large number of persons perhaps 20 million or more, employed in civilian labor forces that are engaged in war production, this notion of honor and privilege of government employment seems to become pretty threadbare. We're now talking about some very large percentage of our population.
But it seems to me, in answer to the question that you raised with me here, we have been accustomed to holding people responsible for their acts.